I mean, since we can't play music in the same room, it's a good time to talk, ain't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well done. Yeah.
So Chris Turner and Rachel Maloney are my second set of like hippie parents, right? You guys have been influencing me in a positive, extremely positive musical psychedelic way since I was a kid.
So, yeah. We met you when you were a kid.
We were at a music camp, and most of the other teachers at this camp would take a normal performance, but Chris Turner and Rachel Maloney would say, "No, we don't need a concert. We just want the biggest jam." And there'd be like a disco ball, flashy, cool party lights, and a big circle. And that, of course, is the Womp.
The big Womp. And of course, don't forget, everybody got costumes.
Oh, yeah. Costumes. Just good vibes. Big woof, big womp. And now, of course, we carry on the womp tradition over at Fiddle Hell.
Yay. Well done.
I like to think of us as vibe wizards. And I feel like we learned a lot of that from you guys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's sort of what we do. Yeah.
So I wanted to go way back because you've had a crazy journey from your childhood running around England and somehow you ended up in America married and like, but I want to hear about what got you into music in the first place.
Okay. So I'll go back to the, I come from a family of harmonica players, and my older brother bought me a harmonica when I was 7 years old, and he taught me how to play a very simple stuff. And he still plays, by the way. He's 7 years older than me.
Oh, wow.
And my dad played, but not very much, but just sort of amateur. And when I was 15, I heard blues, Sonny Terry, the great blues harp player, and I decided I had to do that. So I got very curious about the harp. And so I was originally learning to just, I would just, the first tune I played was. Etc. Nice. But when I, that's one the tune my brother taught me, Blue Danube, just the beginning. It took me years to find out that there's seven parts and it keeps changing keys, which is why I couldn't get much further than that. But then when I was a teenager, I heard. And that was the blues harp player, Sonny Terry, and people like that. And so that's why I started a blues band with my friends, a country blues band in London. And we called the Missouri Compromise. And we got pretty good. We went from being really bad to really good. And we played a lot in the folk clubs. We even made a couple of recordings, which were around for a while on Matchbox. And then when I left school, that was in the high school, started a band, a rock band with my friends called The Screw.
Screw.
Yeah.
And I have the 7-inch.
You had the 7-inch. Oh, good. Yeah, nice. And we had a couple of years where we were pretty successful. We opened up for big bands. We opened for The Stones at Hyde Park and King Crimson. And we opened for different festivals and colleges and gigs. We opened for Pink Floyd at one point.
Wow.
Traffic at another point. Big bands, you know. And we were on we got on a good circuit. But then, unfortunately, our manager who got us all the gigs, Sam Cutler, he ran off with the Stones. Took all the money and ran off. And at the same time, right after the Hyde Park gig, the drummer and myself with our girlfriends, we decided to take the bus home. We were living in South London, and which was a good decision because the reason was it was such a party going on in the band van. We couldn't take it. And it was a good thing because they got busted on the way home. And right in Brixton, brought into the Brixton cop shop. But fortunately for them, they had smoked all the dope. So there was nothing really to bust them on a few, you know, but Doggins.
But they went straight from opening for the Rolling Stones to straight to the jail cell.
Straight to jail, exactly. So, and that was when not only did I got a phone call from the singer's mum, and she said, "Have you read the paper?" And we were on the front page of the South London News. And also Sam, the manager, Sam Cutler, he became the Stones manager. And we never saw him again for years. Hmm. So we sort of imploded up from that point. But we had a couple of good years when we did all those gigs. But I got very disillusioned with the whole rock scene as a result of, doing well and then the whole thing collapsing. But we had our moments, you know. I was sort of being pretty bohemian, and I went on a jazz course and I met this guy, John Stevens. And he was teaching this, how to do this group improvisation, free improvisation, free jazz. And it was a great scene. And I didn't understand it, but I ended up taking his workshops, and I just wanted to show you, this is his book.
John Stevens, Search and Reflect. Look at that.
That was written after his death, but it's a lot of his compositions. Great guy, great drummer, musician, and a cornet player, and great teacher.
Amazing.
So anyway, a music workshop handbook on the Rock School label, if anyone's interested. It's so a good book.
Are you saying you got into free jazz before you got into jazz?
Yeah. Yeah, just by accident, went from blues and psychedelic rock, met these jazz guys, and I said, God, these guys are having so much fun, and I don't understand what they're doing, but I got to do it. So I started to go to John's workshops, and then when I went to college, and Ealing College, part of London University, to study English history and music, and I got John a job teaching, because the music was classical stuff, and I was studying classical and avant-garde music with Christopher Small, who was a great teacher and composer and musician, who is unfortunately dead now, as is John Stevens. But they introduced me to this whole world of free jazz in downtown London, the Little Theatre Club.
Amazing.
It was really fun. Every weekend there would be gigs, and every gig would finish with a big jam session with whoever was there.
Cool. And,
so I used to go and just join in with these guys, and they loved it because they didn't, you know, nobody else was playing harmonica. It was all horns and drums and pianos and things like that, jazz instruments, really. And so they liked the fact that I was a harmonica player. And it was just fun for me. And I went in, I used to go in, and especially for the jams. And I remember talking to people. They were mostly older guys and jazz musicians who were playing this free music. And some of them are pretty famous people. And now it weren't there.
You can tell us their names.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Evan Parker, and Derek Bailey on guitar, Kevin Parker on saxophones. He's still around. But anyway, one weekend I decided not to go. I've been going and I'd been sloughing off from my schoolwork. So I decided to be a good boy and do my schoolwork. Which was a bit of bad timing here. Because I went the following weekend, everyone was running about like nuts. And they were said, last weekend when you weren't here, Miles Davis showed up. Miles Davis was looking for a new band. Right? This is like 71 probably at this point.
Oh my God.
And, because these people who I said to people, like, who's that bass player? Really, he's a great bass player, Dave Holland.
There you have it.
And who's that guitar player? He's a great guitar player. John McLaughlin.
Oh my God.
And so anyway, so everyone was running about going, Miles Davis showed up, and then he nabbed those two guys.
Yeah.
As like, you know, two of the best players in that scene. He wow. had, you know, he was traveling around the world actually looking for people, and he got Dave Holland and John McLaughlin to join his band, and that was the fusion band. It is for, you know, the jazz rock fusion, which he invented basically with that band.
Right.
And, so anyway, that was really exciting, but, you know, like, oh, I miss Miles Davis. Fuck. But anyway, I continued to do all that free jazz with a lot of great players and great people. And it was a scene where I was played with John's band, the Spontaneous Musical Ensemble, and mm-hmm. then a bunch of people, including American guys, Steve Lacy came over and he was around. I don't know if you know him, the saxophone player. And Bobby Bradford, who was Ornette Coleman's first trumpet player
wow.
back in Texas, he came and lived in London.
With heavyweights.
Yeah, very heavyweights, yeah. Bobby was great. He died a couple of years ago, but he was around a long time, and I got to play in his band. We played at, you know, big jazz clubs in downtown London, at Ronnie Scott's and places like that. But Bobby used to come and play. I had a blues band, and we would, by this time we were in the squats in London.
And what are the squats?
In a bohemian, where we would move in, a bunch of hippies would move into a rundown building, fix it up and live in it for free. Yeah, they eventually changed the rules so you couldn't do that. But at the time there was an old medieval law that said you could wow. do that. Yeah, if nobody wow. lived in it, you could move in and live in it for free.
Yeah, you can't do that now.
Can't do that now. Can't, so I was living in a squats for free with my friends, and we were playing free jazz, and I was getting a grant for, you know, for the college, which I didn't go to very much, but it was really fun, very unusual. Oh, look, there's Kitty. Oh, well, look.
This is Viola. Kitty.
Yeah. Well,
the animals are behaving. What a nice yeah, rare
they
moment.
Are. Heck, he's been a good boy. He's keeping me warm.
A good boy.
So anyway, that was a great scene. And when as opposed to the sort of bluesy thing I was just doing, as opposed to that, it was more like
love that.
There you go. A little more abstract and not quite so tonal, but I've been coming back to that recently, just working on different types of free jazz licks, because I loved that music.
Yeah,
I loved playing it. It was so much fun, and I played it on and off since. But you know, there's no money in it. There were very few gigs, and the few gigs that there were didn't pay, and there was very small audiences. So
right,
after
right.
a while, you got like, oh, no, you know, it's time to go back to playing some blues and rock and stuff that, you know, people actually like. You know, it was the people who like free jazz and free music tend to be other musicians.
Right, right.
Yeah, so most of the audience were other musicians who were waiting for the jam session.
But you also, oh, yeah. It also sounds like, I mean, if you're not paying any money to live anywhere, you have more freedom
exactly.
to play music that doesn't pay money and just play it because you like it.
Exactly. That was exactly the way things worked out. And it was great. It was a great scene. It was sort of like the most bohemian period in my life, really, when I was just didn't have much money, but didn't need much money, and playing all this wild, crazy music. For wow. just for fun with a bunch of other people who were doing the same thing. And as I said, you know, people were coming from all over the place, including America, but different parts of Europe, because the London free jazz scene in the early 70s had a reputation because it was so much fun. And it was largely because of this guy, John Stevens, because he'd given all these workshops and got us to play this crazy music. He had his own sort of theory of how to improvise together, which had nothing to do with variations over a chord progression or whatever the basic right. is for jazz, regular jazz.
Man, I can't, it's so incredible thinking like free jazz with John McLaughlin and Dave Holland.
Yeah, I didn't even know. They like, weren't big names at that time, you know, well, but they were just.
But they were really there. Good, eh?
Yeah, must yeah. But, and there was a bunch of other great players, too, who were around. And so I got to play with all these great people, you know, even in jam sessions. Although, as I said, I played in Bobby's band.
Yeah.
And John Stevens' band. And that was great. So
was that fun. About the same time frame that Rachel knocked on the door?
Yes, exactly. I was living in the squats in Camden Town in London, and Rachel had just come from Germany, where she'd been glassblowing, and she was looking for a place to live. And she knew some people. There were some Americans who were friends of hers who lived a couple of doors down, and she came and she was visiting them, and it turned out that there was still a little bit of room in our squat. And then she moved in, and then we got together. And then she, you know, started to play the fiddle, and she was already played a bit of fiddle, and she joined in with some of the free jazz. And then we played in this group called the Portsmouth Symphonia. I don't know if you've heard of them, but it was like a sort of crazy avant-garde comedic orchestra that would do classics like Tchaikovsky's 1812 and Sprach Zarathustra by Strauss and stuff like that. But we did really weird, wonky versions. I played trumpet in that band, of course. And anyway, we played in that band.
Wow. I just looked it up, founded in by a group of students at the Portsmouth School of Art in 1970.
That's right. Wow. Yeah. And then moved to London, and we did a lot of gigs. We played the Royal Albert Hall, stuff like that. We had quite a following, because it was a send up of classical music, really.
Right, right.
But it was sort of avant-garde as well. It was a crazy scene. And then I got back into, you know, blues and jazz. As I said, Bobby Bradford used to come and play with our blues band, because he was from Texas and he had started out playing blues along with Ornette. And so that was really fun. And then after a few years of living in squats and doing all that stuff, Rachel was at the Royal College of Art, and she finished there, and I finished at my college at London, and then we moved here, and then I ended up.
Where's here? You're in Rhode Island?
In Boston,
yeah.
Yeah, and then met these guys who had a rock band in Providence, went back and forth to the West Coast, and then came back here, and they asked me to join their band. The Otis and Ridley band. It was like a singer-songwriter, I don't know what you call it, country rock band.
Yeah.
Played with them. And then after a couple of years of that, we started the Nee Ningy band.
The Nee Ningy band.
Nee Ningy with playing with a lot of, and that was really fun, with a lot of fiddle tunes and all sorts of stuff. That mix of traditional, you know, Irish, English, Scottish, American, Cajun, old-timey, whatever. Anything that appealed to us with our friend Ted Porter.
The melting pot.
The melting pot of folk. Folk melt, we called it.
So what's the harmonica sound of the Nee Ningy band?
Yeah, well, then we started to do all these different different types of musics, different, and I got very much into playing the tremolo harmonica, a very different type of harmonica.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff like that, and we got again with Ni Ningi, we got pretty successful. We traveled around, started out playing the little pubs and clubs, and then ended up playing festivals, and we got a manager down in North Carolina and ended up moving down there to be near her, and she got us all these gigs, and we played all the way up and down the East Coast for years, and that was fun.
Epic.
We continued doing it for quite a few years, which was great.
Love it.
And we played in various different folk bands, and also got into playing with a bunch. There was a bunch of, we moved to Durham, North Carolina. My hero, Sonny Terry, came and stayed with us. And so that was fun because he was from there. So he came and visited. And we got to play with a bunch of old bluesmen. Big Boy Henry, played with him a lot, and Legless Arthur Lyons and John D. Holman, who just died. A bunch of North Carolina blues guys who never really hit the big time, but a lot of them were great music. So that was a treat to play with these old blues guys who were, you know, my heroes, basically. And I learned a lot from playing with them as you know, that you can learn from recordings and you can learn by practicing, but there's something about playing with people. There's like something embeds itself deeply inside you, you know, with
playing
that.
Music with other humans, the thing that we've missed the most over the past 2 years.
It's been so sad, this whole COVID thing is. Yeah, we've hardly, I mean, apart from last summer when we saw you guys and some, but then the Delta came along and the Omicron, and we haven't really done any of that because didn't want to take the risk. As I think I mentioned to you, a bunch of my friends who kept playing ended up getting sick. So darn. I haven't been doing it, you know.
Since this is part of the River of Suck podcast, I wanted to tell you a little bit about this concept. The question that I ask everybody is, how do you see the River of Suck in your life? What I think it comes down to is there's a lot of suffering when your dreams seem impossible, and how do we keep going? You guys have been through the ringer a million times in some ways that I don't know anyone else who's done some of the crazy stuff you guys have. So anyway, without further ado, this is the River of Suck. You're standing on one edge of the River of Suck. You're on your comfort shore. Behind you is your comfort cave. And you can look on the other side all the way across and see little teeny versions of yourself. They're small because they're far away, right? It's tiny versions of yourself who can do the things that you wish you could do now. The problem is, in between you and the future versions of yourself, is there's a big raging river of suck, which represents all that suffering to get to the other side. That river of suck is filled with rocks, it's filled with whitewater rapids, and it's filled with thought piranhas, that part of your brain that won't shut up. I'll never be good enough. What will they think of me? Does that make any sense? Have you experienced this in your life?
Well, you know, life is full of ups and downs, but, you know, I feel like we've been very, very fortunate, because if you're a musician and if you can just keep doing it in whatever way, then, oh, sorry, the dog is dogging. Hey, I always feel like music keeps me going. And when things get bad, it pulls me through, you know. And I've always felt that ever since I started to play seriously as a teenager. I was very, like a lot of teenagers, full of angst and miserable, you know, going to school, hated it, all that stuff. And here I was. And blues was the first thing that made sense to me. Hmm. And, you know, just getting to do that and getting to make those waily, you know, wah-wah noises has always been this great joy that, as I said, no matter how difficult things may get, that in itself is just something that is so great to do. And of course, especially great with other people. And still get to do it with all sorts of people, including you. That's been, you know, it's been a joy for us to meet you guys and play with you guys and have you guys be part of our lives. And it's been a great pleasure. And, you know, I've had some serious health issues the last few years, but still playing music. And as I said, as long as I can keep playing, that helps a lot. And it's just, it's good for the spirit, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there we go. Yeah. Does that sort of answer what you said?
Yeah. You just reminded me, Johnny Watson Jr., right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was a great inspiration because, you know, he was a cripple and, you know, black guy, very hard life with terrible health issues and multiple surgeries. And yet he continued and, you know, continues, although he's pretty ill now. He's in a home. But, for you know, he would, you know, keep singing. And he loved to sing blues. He was originally a gospel singer in the church, like a lot of those guys are. And then he just always kept going. And the singing, kept him going.
He told me that music was the only thing keeping him alive.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Implying, of course, to us, never stop playing music.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Even when things are bad, if you can just, you know, make the time and preferably play with some other people, or but even just by yourself, it will just raise your spirits and keep you going, even when times are tough. And times are often tough, and times are tough right now. You know, with COVID, I mean, for everyone, and especially for performing artists, it's really a difficult time. As I said, I mean, I'm not actually doing any gigs right now, partially because of my health and partially because I can't take a risk of getting COVID because I'm high risk being older and with a pre-existing condition. But hopefully, you know, COVID will subside and then we can all get back together and have jam sessions and play music. And you know, some of my favorite, I mean, I've done a lot of great gigs all over the world, but some of my favorite musical moments have been jam sessions.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably true of a lot of people and probably true of you too, including some of our jams. You know, like I said, I mean, that was the thing about the free jazz scene, is that it was the jamming where the best stuff happened. You know,
yeah,
and
the best stuff never gets recorded, eh?
And best stuff never gets recorded, and it's always, you know, midnight, and everybody's out of their heads, and there's wild and crazy moments happen, and we've had plenty together, in fact.
That's right.
We even had a few really good sessions this summer, but as I said, then the COVID, you know, raised its ugly head again.
Here's a more esoteric question, I guess, that's related is. I mean, we're here on this planet, right? This is the only planet we got that we know of.
Yep.
Do you think that music channels the universe in some way? Like, what is the power of music?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I know that it is very important for people to play it and listen to it and join in with it. You know, and I'm very into sort of joining in thing, and that was especially, you know, always been true, and especially that was John Stevens's, the free jazz guy, that was his thing, was get everybody to do it, you know, everybody to, no matter what level you're at, you know, you could join in with the things that he did. And so I think that, you know, have, and that's how tribal people are, sort of everybody joins in. You mm-hmm. don't really have an audience as such, you know, everybody's right, right. part of the performance. And I probably told you this once. I had this dream that, it was when there was one of the little fish went extinct. And I remember being very sad when I heard about it. And I had this dream that God was talking to the angels. And he said, you know, I'm just going to get rid of those people because they're just too much of a nuisance and they're just destroying the planet and all this other stuff on it. And the angel Gabriel, the trumpet player, the Miles yeah. Davis of the angel world, said, well, I think you should listen to this. And, you know, dialed in some stuff from the planet Earth, which people were playing, including people like us. And God said, oh, okay, well, I'll give him a break and give him a bit longer and we'll see how it goes. It was an actual dream. And I woke up and went, wow.
You had that dream?
Yeah.
Holy shit. I don't remember hearing about that. That is
okay. I don't know who I told about it, but anyway, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you told me about it.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean that was a crazy, you know, sort Whoa. Of thing that popped Whoa. Into my head. But the angel Gabriel said, No, you don't understand. That you've got to listen to this. This is worth it. In spite of all the bad things they do. They do this. They make these noises that are special.
So, you know, wow, that is an incredible dream. And anything that I have to say is not as deep and meaningful as that. But I think you wouldn't, there's a movie where some aliens come to destroy humans and take over Earth. And one of them that's sent ahead to like scope it out, finds out about music and like gets a guitar and starts playing at an open mic. And they develop a fan base. When the other aliens come to kill all the people, there's like, no, wait, listen to this. And they play them a song and they're like, oh,
it's the same idea.
The music and of course, saves the planet.
You save the planet. And of course, Sun Ra was convinced that his orchestra, you know, Sun Ra, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sun Ra and the
super
Sun Ra
out.
Orchestra.
Super
yeah,
out.
Super out. Weird. Yeah. Music. Jazz, free jazz, and great, great musicians. We saw them several times. Great people, and he was convinced that his music was the thing that was keeping the aliens from invading. It was the same idea because space is the place. It was his big piece. Anyway. Nice.
I want to hear about what went wrong, right? Because music to the outsider looks like all we do is have fun and everything is great. But you have been through some proverbial and some literal
Yeah.
So I want to hear about how you came to be a stowaway on a ship.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so we decided to go to Africa and we hitchhiked down through the Sahara, mm-hmm. which was a scene in itself. And then we ended up meeting these people actually who were from Providence, in fact.
Whoa.
This is when we were still living in the squats in London. So we hitchhiked down to the Gambia and on the way, went through Morocco and Spanish Sahara. We ended up in a war in Spanish Sahara. Did Oops. I tell you that story?
No. What?
We were camping on the beach, and we heard this machine gun fire, and we poked our noses out of our tent, and it's on right on the edge of the Sahara, just goes all the way down to the Atlantic, and boom, the beach is the Sahara. Anyway, there were tanks and people running about with guns and shooting each other. And so we just sort of kept our heads down, and then we decided to go somewhere else, which we did. That was in Spanish Sahara, as it was then.
Wow.
Anyway, we ended up in the Gambia and met this guy, Jeliyama Suso, who was the griot of his tribe and actually the national musician. And he took us back to his village. We lived in a mud hut in the Gambia.
Wow.
And he played us all night. He was a kora player. And he played us, started off by playing the national anthem of the Gambia. And he played us, you know, I told him I was English, so he played God Save the Queen and all that. And then he kept playing, and he played as he saw how interested we were. He kept retuning his instrument back into weirder and weirder tunings to play older and older music until eventually we ended up, he said, this is the music from before the white men arrived in Africa, and ended up doing these great long sort of Homeric ballads about ancient wars and stuff.
Wow.
Which was really, that was a pretty special night. And anyway, we traveled around Africa. I got sort of pretty ill. That was my first sort of big illness.
Ran out of money. Raw vegetables.
Yeah, I think it was probably bad water or something.
Oh, yeah, the water. Ooh.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, we ended up in some bad situations within the sandstorm and dysentery. But anyway, we ended up with no money back in Dakar. I was just playing on the streets to make a few pennies. And we went around the boats because we'd heard that you could stow away. And so we went around the boats and we...
Why not?
We met these English sailors, and they said they would stow us away on their boat, which was going from Dakar to Sweden, a British boat. The Cano Palm, it was called. And... we went there that night, and they put us in an empty cabin, and we were gone for 2 weeks. They kept us fed. They would bring us food. We were like their sort of project. You know, they were young guys. They were young hippies. They had great dope. They would come and bring us these, because they come from Africa. We'd all get really stoned, and they kept us out of getting caught. But then, of course, when we went originally, we met them and they said, you can go ask the captain, because sometimes the captain will let you on. We knocked on the captain's cabin before we stowed away. And here we were, a couple of hippies looking very bedraggled. Door flew open and there's this great big red-headed, red-bearded Scotsman standing there with a bottle of whiskey in his hand, and he said, the answer's no, and slammed the door. And we were standing there like, whoa. And we went back and we met up with the crew, the sailors. What was it? Bob and Jethro. And they said, okay, we'll sneak you on. And they snuck us on. And we were out in that little cabin, which was, the crew have a separate area on the boat from the from the officers. So that's how we got away with it. And one night there was a terrible storm, and Jethro came. He was great, and a big strapping guy from Yorkshire. And he came in and he said, we're in the middle of the night in a terrible storm. We're in a minefield in the Baltic Sea, because there were still minefields from World War II. And the captain is drunk, and the captain is on the wheel, because the captain in the minefields, the captain has to take the wheel.
Sure.
Because the captain knows where the mines are. But he was drunk and on the wheel, in a minefield, in a terrible storm, in the middle of the night. Jethro came and told us that. We were like, okay, well, you know, I guess we've had a good life so far, so that was fine. But anyway, we got through it. And then we got to Malmo in Sweden.
But hold on. How did you not be discovered? You know, food, bathroom, like?
Yeah, well, the bathroom was just down the hall. And the sailors would come and they would say, okay, it's safe to go to the bathroom. And they would bring us food, you know, because they got pretty good food, actually. And so they brought us food. And that's how they did it. And then at the very end, they snuck us off. We had to walk by the officer's cabin, which with the door open. Jethro was a great big strapping guy, and he stood in the doorway, and we whipped past, went down the gangplank. And it so happened that Malmo did not have a customs. So we just walked off, and that was really great. And there we were in Sweden. We got to Denmark, and we were in the train station, and I started playing, and this guy came up to us from the Faroe Islands, and he gave us some Faroe Island money, which looked like sort of play money or something, but it turned out to be a lot of money.
Wow.
It was enough to get us back to London. So that's how we got back to London. So
did you pick up any instruments? Were you able to get them back? Or?
Oh, yeah, we did. We brought a Barlophone and a Cora, which I gave to a friend of mine, and some Shawms, which I've still got some, and flutes. We ended up selling the Barlophone. It was too much to carry about, but that was really fun. But I used to go and, you know, jam with people on the street and, you know, the musicians there in Dakar, yeah. And so that was fun. But, wow. Yeah, it was a crazy adventure, and we almost died on several occasions. But we made it back to the squats and kept squatting, and wow. Then eventually came over here. So, and then that was Knee Ningi and all that stuff.
Do you have any big Knee Ningi disasters?
You know, mostly we just toured around and played and had a lot of fun.
Nice.
And then after that, we did the big Zucchinis, and that was fun too. And then after that, we got the job here in Providence working at Trinity Rep, the theater company downtown. And we worked there on and off for about 20 years.
Wow.
As musicians for the plays. And, you know, if you get hired for a play, it's 10, 12 weeks or something. And so we do a few of those a year and then do, you know, bands and tours and things like that as well.
Would you say one of the things that has saved you guys with music is flexibility?
I would think so. Yeah, being able to do all this different stuff. And
because that's not all the music that's like deep inside your heart, right? That's like,
yeah,
we're going to get paid by doing something. And
we always played from the heart, you know, I think, and, you know, did all the traditional stuff as well and learned a lot of music. And when we worked in the theater, we got to use a lot of our musical knowledge, which, you know, we'd acquired by traveling all over the place and playing in bands and doing all this stuff. And, you know, you could work in fiddle tunes or you could work in some free jazz or depending on the play, you know.
Wow.
And so that was, you know, it was interesting and got to do a lot of bands, blues bands, folk bands. And lots of jam sessions, including with you guys, and lots of music camps, including with you guys. So
I know a name that you have a disaster for.
What's that?
Big Nazo.
Big Nazo. Oh, you want a Big Nazo story? Yeah. There's a few of them. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the story of one of the gigs that we did in Providence.
So who is Big Nazo?
Oh, it's a puppet rock band. And I joined them. So a friend of ours, Aminio Pinkway, runs it.
It's like Guar, but no blood.
That's right. Yeah. And what they did sort of rock tunes, and they lost their sax player. And so I stepped in. I said, I'm not going to do this for long. But it was a crazy scene. I think all the stories from Big Nazo are pretty crazy. We did that. We did the tour up to Halifax in... And that was the tour where we ended up in the St. John's with all the teenage Canadian customs officers, the young women. And we were the rock band, and they were telling us, no, we can't deal with you because you don't have the right stamps in your passport and all that stuff. And then we ended up getting out of there and getting to Halifax, and they had showed up with one little hatchback for us, it was crazy because we had a whole rock band with all these puppets.
Like 10 people, right? That's a big production.
Oh, yes, like 10, 12 people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, we ended up on the stage, and as we were sound checking, the stage people hadn't actually screwed down the stage, and one of the singers fell through and got her leg crushed and ended up in the hospital for the rest of the tour. I know. And that was the tour where they left the student guy on the main desk and the howling feedback obliterated everybody's ears before we went on. That was really awful. They finally figured that one out. But the story I was going to tell you was the story of
fire.
We were the fire. Yeah, we were playing in Providence. I just could see a slit out of my mask, and I just saw all the it was a popular band, and could see all the people with their kids, and it was an outdoor concert, and everybody was having fun and running about, and you could see their happy faces, yay! And then you saw their faces suddenly turn to horror. And then there was this terrible smell of chemical weapons, and then the audience fled, and I could just see this out of the slits in my helmet. And I looked around, and out of the main speakers, the main bins, huge flames were bursting, and it was an electrical fire in the PA system. And I looked over to the sound men, and they were just standing there, sound men, smoking a joint. They hadn't noticed that the main PA had huge flames coming out of it, and the audience was fleeing in terror. And meanwhile, did you know that song by Arthur Brown, Fire? Fire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't want you to burn down. And we opened for him away with the screw, Arthur Brown. And anyway, Armenia went into that song. And gradually everyone left, and gradually all of the band left except for me and the drummer and Armenia, who was the singer. And then eventually he stopped and we left, and the whole PA was on fire. Yay, how about that? That was pretty catastrophic.
How do you come back from that?
Yeah, well, that was the end of that gig.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
The gig was over. Did you, I just have to ask, did you continue to say yes to Big Nazo gigs?
I did. I told him I will do the gigs until you get a sax player. And I did them until he got a sax player. And then I left because I really didn't want to play in that band because it was just a litany of disasters, basically, that being the most extraordinary of the lot. But for some reason, I don't know why, the Big Nazo is, I don't know, plagued by catastrophe, but very entertaining, and they have a big following.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I've seen them, and it's a great show. It's just, it's a big show.
It's a big show.
So, it's easy to see how the music production could go awry.
Yeah. It goes awry a lot. Yeah.
So welcome back, friends. We need to tell you that the first interview is over and we're in a new one. So it's a new day.
Yay!
And we're still here. So
still here.
Part two.
Still
part
here.
Two.
And,
what I wanted to ask you more about is some like deeper music questions, like about the universe and stuff. So for me, it feels like you use music as a refuge from like life.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that it does is when you're playing is that you are playing, you're in the moment, and you're not thinking about anything else. You're not thinking, oh, you know, but for me, you know, like my health sucks, or, you know, the world is descending into catastrophe or whatever it is that, you know, the stuff that is around us, you lose yourself in the moment. And, you know, as I mentioned to you earlier, we had some friends over this weekend. They came and stayed, and we spent the whole weekend playing music, and it was so much fun. Especially, we've been locked down a lot because of COVID. There's something about, you know, playing with people. Music is really a good communal art. And when you've got a lot of people, it's sort of, you know, everybody feeds the energy into one another. And so we just start playing, and then someone suggests, oh, let's do this. And then someone else suggests, oh, let's do that. And you get something where you may be by yourself, you might play for an hour or something and then have had enough. But if you've got a bunch of us, I mean, we play for hours and hours and hours. And you know all about this because we've done it together many, many times. And I think it's sort of like it's a way for the human energy to be transmitted between one another that is very delightful and safe. And it's just playing music together is such a joy, you know. No matter, even if you're feeling glum.
Do you often feel glum?
Well, I do, and I'm sure that lots of people do at different times. But actually, when you're feeling glum, if you get together with your buds and play some tunes, it pretty much puts you into a good mood, I would say, generally speaking. And as I said, it's been sad with COVID that we haven't been able to get together with our friends nearly as much just because of being careful. And we haven't gotten it. I don't want it because I have health issues, as you know. And but when we finally do get together, like we just did, it's a great joy, you know, great joy to play. It's great joy to play anyway. But it's a great joy to play with other people, and especially with people who are your friends. And we've been playing together for years, like we have with you. And we have a large repertoire of things, and you just get going in that zone. And before you know it, it's 5 hours later, you know, or whatever. Everybody's in a great mood, you know.
Yeah. Do you think that having a chronic illness has affected your attitude about music in any way?
No, I would say that for me, music is one of the things that sort of gets me through all the days. And even when I was in the hospital for a whole month a little while ago, and I had another surgery, and Rachel and some of my other friends, Lynn's came in, and different people came in. I had my own room, and we had little jam sessions, and it was just, you know, and there were days when I just felt really, really down because I was so ill and in the hospital and didn't know how the surgery was going to work out. And then we'd get together and play some music together, and it's like, everything's okay, at least for the moment, you know. So yeah, it's great. I mean, music is great. It's a great. It's like a divine gift or something, you know.
Yeah.
And no matter how you do it, I mean, even if you do it by yourself, but I always have felt like, and this weekend really brought it home because we haven't really been getting together with people that much. We play together, Rachel and myself, but we haven't been doing the big jams like we normally do. And we finally got to have a bit of a fun jam out the back there. You've been there many times. And it feels great. Everyone felt great afterwards, you know, and we're all like, oh, we've got to do it again. It's like a drug that you get addicted to. You know all this already.
It occurred to me that this conversation and the way that you think about struggle in music is it's opposite of every single other person that I've talked to on this podcast. people generally are like feeling a lot of self-doubt about like their music, their abilities, whether they'll be accepted into their communities of jammers, whether or not their facility on the instrument or their ability to listen is going to let them join the jam. And so we talk about that struggle of kind of not being good at something, but wanting to be really good at something, and how that path is just kind of treacherous, right? It is a treacherous path.
Yeah.
Down that river of suck.
Yes, right. Yeah. I'd have to give you the one of my favorite quotes about, you know, so that relates to that somewhat, is the quote from Albert Eiler. If you know, do you know him? Albert Eiler, the tenor sax player, great free jazz player.
I don't believe so. 60s. How do we spell that and, last name?
Yeah. A-Y-L-E-R. Yeah, he's pretty famous. And he was murdered, unfortunately. He lived in New York. Anyway, people used to sort of criticize him, his technique in the jazz world. The jazz world can be very like that, especially
because
you don't have enough facility on your instrument or something. And his line was, technique is that which you need to express yourself.
Mm.
And I thought that was a great way of putting it because, you know, you can gain all sorts of technique and still not be saying what you want to say. Or you could have a very simple technique and be saying what you want to say, because it's really about expressing yourself. It's really saying what you want to say.
Yeah.
And hopefully other people like it, and hopefully other people can relate to it and join in. But really it is about what you want to say with music. And so once you can do that, then you're there, basically. That's it. I mean, you know, and even if it's a simple thing, it could be simple. That's okay.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question to a certain extent?
Sure. Yeah. What would you say to someone who is, let's say, newer to music and they feel like they're not enough?
Well, I mean, you can always get better, and everybody, you know, you can always get better. I always feel like I can always, you know, still get better at what I'm doing. But I think that you also have to be happy with what you're doing, with where you are in that sort of journey, if you like. And so you don't let the that idea of, you know, I'm not good enough and I've got to get better. I mean, it's good to keep getting better, but if that inhibits you and makes you miserable, then it's that's not a good thing. It's better to be, you know, happy with what you're doing, you know, and even if it's just really simple.
Yeah.
And I remember we used to do a lot of theater, and sometimes I'd be so tired afterwards, and I had a gig, and I would go to the gig, which was just around the corner. The Trinity Brew Pub, you came there quite a few times, and in Providence. And it's interesting because I would just like play the first few chords on the harp, and it's sort of like everything was okay. You know, if you're tired or you're grumpy or, you know, feeling bad about something, it's like you just play and, oh, yeah, that's great. That's it. It could just be very, very simple. Just the sound will take you there, you know.
Hmm.
That's the way I feel anyway.
Yeah.
And, yeah, play. I mean, simple is great, you know. I mean, that was also a quote from Chopin, who would say, you know, to his students, oh, it's very, very nice what you're playing, but or what you're writing, but, you know, if you can make it even simpler, it will be even better, because it doesn't have to be complicated, doesn't have to be difficult. I mean, it can be, but sometimes the most lovely piece of music is very, very simple. And
right.
And you can just get delight from it, you know. So does that answer some of that?
Yeah, the idea that playing something simple and good is playing something better than complicated and bad is...
Yeah, I don't think you need to have it thought that way. You don't have to think. I think some people think that, you know, they're not good enough because they're not playing complicated, might be not playing enough notes or something. But it's really, I mean, it's about feeling, isn't it? It's about, like I say, expression, you know.
Right.
Tyler's line about, you know, technique is what you need to express yourself. So if you're expressing yourself with a simple technique or a peculiar technique or lots of technique, it doesn't matter, because if you're expressing yourself, that's the whole point. But nice. That's the way I see it anyway.
I love that.
Yeah.
So I have some questions about composition and I guess the nature of music. So I'll just state it simply.
The nature of music. Is that what you said? The nature of music?
Yeah. What is music? And I guess part of that is, what is art? Is it this, like, what is it? And is it bigger than what we think of it as?
Yeah, I think that what happens with music is that it's something about it that sort of tunes in your brain, your emotions, and that sort of takes you to a different world. And, it's a, you know, people have asked this question throughout the centuries and written books about it and stuff. Like, yeah. Why do people play music? You know, it doesn't actually make any sense on many levels. It doesn't, you know, help us sort of solve all these problems or anything like that. But I think people do it because there's something about it that makes you feel really good. And I think that also it's not just feeling. They have found, and you probably know this, that music really helps people's intelligence in different fields. So I'll just tell you a little story that sort of relates.
Okay.
My brother taught me to play the harmonica. My older brother, David, he's 7 years older than me. And when I was on my seventh birthday, he bought me a harmonica. And my dad played and my brother played, and he taught me how to play. Just the beginning of the Blue Danube. And we used to play together, and he still plays. Anyway, some years ago, he had a stroke, and he woke up one morning and he couldn't speak. And he had had the stroke in the night, and then he had to go to hospital and all that, and he couldn't read or write or anything like that. And they got him back playing the harmonica, and he started to play the harmonica, and that got him into singing again, and the singing led him back into speaking and then reading and writing. And he's, you know, more or less okay, more or less recovered. I mean, he has some health issues, but, you know, he's an old guy now. But, you know, the harmonica playing brought him back out of this terrible situation, that, you know, step by step. And and they say that that's not such an uncommon thing, not necessarily harmonica, but just music will help you get back into all those, you know. They've worked with people who've had strokes and, like him, lost the ability to speak and lost the ability to read and write.
Yeah.
And music helps people get back into it. So it's this profound thing that actually, when they found now that there are many different centers in the brain that are musical, and that when you play music or you listen to music, all these different places light up when these scientists make these things. But anyway, that's my personal story about my brother, is that the harmonica got him back into the world, you know, which is brilliant. Thank you. another little anecdote that sort of, I remember at your party the first time I met Dan Goodman.
Yeah.
Who was doing great. We're still in touch with him. Your good buddy.
Oh, yeah.
He's such a great guy. And I remember at the party, and he'd been studying philosophy, and he was like so involved in thought, you know. And I at one point I said to him, I said, Dan, you need to shut some of that stuff off, you know. And I think that a good way to do it is to learn to play the harmonica. Ah. And he took lessons from me, plays the harmonica, and he agreed straight away. Mm. And you know, it's like you can use stuff like that, even if it's just simple playing, to just go to a different place. You know, like you say, like stop the thinking, stop the worrying, just enjoy the sound.
Yeah.
The Italian word for the jaw harp, the Jew's harp, is scaccia pensieri, which means forget your thoughts. It's a great line.
Wow.
Forget your thoughts. Just by, you know, even the simple boing, boing, boing on the Jew harp, you can go to a place where you're no longer worrying about it. And I think that it's like you can just let the sound take you there. You know,
yeah.
You don't, rather than worrying about, oh my God, am I good enough on my instrument? It's less like play your instrument and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And if, you know, my attitude is if people like it, great. But if they don't like it, if you having fun doing it, it's fine, you know. Because really, ultimately, it's nice to have it. To do it for other people and have people enjoy it, and even better if they're going to pay you for it, it's great. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, that's not what is really important. What's really important is that you love it and you do it because you love it. Mm. And as I said before, doing it with your friends and having you all love it, it gives you this big, you know, super group energy, which is fab. And whether there's an audience or isn't an audience, it doesn't really matter, you know. I can see what you're saying is that, you know, people, and I think it's true in all fields of music, but especially like in classical music or jazz, you know, which are very technically demanding. You have this, you know, idea of not being good enough. But I think that's a destructive sentiment, and it's really best to just like love it for what it is, you know. And as I said, even if it's very simple, like my brother coming back to life with playing, he just plays some simple folk tunes, and that brought him back into the world, you know.
Yeah,
lovely thing.
I love that answer. I do want to press you even harder. What is music in the first place? What is it?
Well, it's the manipulation of pitch, isn't it? It's about pitch, which is basically rhythm. So, you know, you have pitch is rhythm, right? It's oscillation.
Yeah.
It's just we hear it pitch as opposed to rhythm. And the reason why we like consonants is because it's those overtones all lining up. Right, that you hear when you hear a chord, and they're all, especially if it's in, if you're in, playing in, we just had this conversation about with a friend of mine about just intonation and equal temperament. And just intonation is when you have all the overtones are lining up the Pythagorean scale, but we call it just now. All the overtones lining up, and this does something for your brain. It's sort of like it retunes your brain or something into the reason why so many songs are 1-4-5 chords, you know, is because those simple progressions have a sort of, they're basic in the overtone series, and they help you feel good, basically. I mean, that's sort of what it comes down to. Does that help at all? The scientific element.
I love this idea that that pitches are rhythm because they're waveforms oscillating. That is a That is a wild thing. But I've sat with you at dawn after a big party listening to crickets, and we've talked about how that's music too. So it's not just a human thing.
That's right. No, that's right. I mean, birds, I remember sitting in the dawn and listening to the birds' dawn chorus and having these amazing sort of revelations about, remember they were sort of waves of rhythm in the way the bird songs were interrelating and stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, birds are a great example. But, and it's just as musicians, it's sort of us adding our little bit to the sound universe. we've just been doing a lot of stuff with singing bowls. It's the same idea, which of course, you know, from the Tibetan, it's a meditative technique to just get those harmonics moving so that you can feel more peaceful, I guess. There's a lot of it, but or, you know, express whatever. I mean, you can express, you know, joy, anger, frustration through music, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's rhythm. Rhythm, when rhythm becomes fast enough, it becomes pitch. So once you've got 16 beats to the second, it becomes pitch. You know, and then it becomes, you know, the faster it gets, the higher the pitch goes. That's why we have A at 440.
Yeah.
The Germans came up with that. I said that's a German decision, because it's really not A 440. That's because that's the note on the oboe that the orchestra is tuned to, because it's actually C is 256 cycles per second in regular 440 pitch. And if 256, half of that is 128. And half of that is 64, and half of that is 32, and half of that is 16. Whoa. And that's where we start to hear pitch, rhythm become pitch.
Wow.
So, and then it goes 8, 4, 2. So, and then it goes up and up and up. So,
yeah, it's funny you bring up the 440 thing, because there's whole segments of the music people who believe 432 is some in tune with the universe, or the Baroque tuning of 415 down a half step.
Yeah, there's various different tunings. The reason that they do that is because before the standardization of pitch, which happened at the beginning of the 20th century, by the Germans came up with that
as right.
a scientific decision. If you, I used to have a chart of organs, the pitch of organs all over Britain, old organs, and they were all over the place. I mean, there was no standardization, and the reason they standardized was mainly because of wind instruments, because you couldn't retune them.
Right.
And you know, a wind band from one town couldn't play with the wind band from the next town, so that's why they standardized. But in fact,
it seems like a good
look
idea
at the way, yeah, if you looked at the way it was in the past, when I looked at this series of pitches of the organs, they were mostly lower than 440, but some of them were higher, and they were all different. And I think generally speaking, they were lower, and that's why the early music people have chosen 415 as, you know, something to choose, but there was no standardization.
Sure.
The old Baroque music wasn't in 415. Some of
That's
it may
right.
have been. Some of it was probably in 440. You know, it was all over the place. So
that's right.
Actually, there's several different ones. There's 396, and there's some different ones.
Wow, that's low.
because generally it was lower. Oh, I was saying that a lot of orchestras are going higher now. A friend of ours who's a vibraphone player, he got a tour of Europe, and he brought his American vibes, which were in 440, and he got to Germany, and they were all playing in 444. And he had to rent a new set because, you know, you can't retune vibes. So, yeah, you know, that's an example of it changes, you know. Changes. But right, 440, that's the thing I told you about 256 and the numbers is that's why they chose it, not because of 440, but because of 256. Middle C is 256.
I did not know that. That is cool.
Yeah, so it's a good piece of information if you're interested in such things, you know.
Yeah, I mean, music is sort of like, I think of time as our canvas, right? Painters paint on objects or they paint on canvases of various types. But for music, I feel like time is our canvas. We're painting time go for it.
That's right. It's very well put. Yes. I mean, one of the ways to think about it is in some ways, music is an articulation of time. You know, it's a way of marking time, if you like. And it's great that we've just been, you know, we took this horrible COVID time that's been going on for a couple of years when we haven't been doing, as I said earlier, we haven't been doing our big jams and all that.
Right.
And unfortunately, but we've been learning a lot of new tunes, which are mostly old. Some of them are very old, hundreds of years old.
New old tunes.
Old new tunes. And I always think this is, I love it. I love to play a piece of music that, you know, people loved to play like 500 years ago.
Yeah.
It's like we get a feeling from it that presumably they got. You know, mm-hmm. It's like this connection across the generations. And it's like, oh, that makes perfect sense. You know, it still resonates with us. And, you know, we've gotten playing some of these medieval pieces and they're lovely. I just love them, you know, and having so much fun doing it, teaching it to our friends.
Yeah.
Our friend Lynn, who you know so well, like you, she's learned a lot of our repertoire. She's teaching it to all these young people. And it's so great. It's like a continuum. You know, we learned them from different places. And here they are. They're going along, passed on to other people. How great is that?
In that way, music is one of the closest things we have to time travel. You know, I feel like if I put on an old record, you feel like you're just right in the room, right at that moment that it was recorded, even if the musicians are no longer with us. And
that's right. Yeah.
But if you take the idea of a 500-year-old tune, we don't have any recordings of it, but even just the experience of learning it and playing it is kind of time travel in a way.
It is.
Closest we can get.
Thank goodness that, you know, musical notation has been developed, because before recording, that's how we set it down. And of course, we've learned a lot of these old things from notation, which is fortunately, but you know, you've got to bring it to life by playing it. But I just was reading about some people, they opened a tomb somewhere. I forget where it was. And found a flute, a bone flute, this is like 8,000 years old or something, and they found some musical notation that went with it. But it's not the notation we're familiar with, obviously. But these, you know, nerdy musicologists sort of figured out, and obviously there's a certain amount of guesswork involved, what these tunes were, because they tried them out on the flute. And so they've actually found, I haven't heard this stuff, but there's some sort of group in, I think they're in Sweden or something, that is specializing in resurrecting, you know, things that aren't just a few hundred years old, but are thousands of years old. How great is that? Reaching way back into human history.
I just looked it up. The 8,000-year-old bone flutes are coming out of central China.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Nice. So that's a great thing. You know, that we have this connection to people who died ages ago, but they were playing music. And if we can connect somehow to their spirits with by redoing the music, it's so great. You know, as I said, the notation is very different, obviously, but they've got some sort of notation. Anyway.
Cool. You know, we've talked a lot of, in our times playing music together, about kind of trying to channel the universe. So the kind of music comes from the universe and then passes through our bodies and out of our instruments. And we want to get our bodies out of the way to let the music flow. So what my question is how do you find the inspiration from the universe when you're composing or improvising?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good way, I was thinking about it because you had asked about it before. And I'm sure that it's a lot of people have had this same experience, is that I've had, and I'm sure you have, sometimes a piece of music will come to you in a dream. And you'll wake up, and in my experience, it's always been sort of sing it or play it or write it down or something, and it always is not quite the way it was in the dream. But that's a great example of obviously it's your brain that you're, even if you're asleep, but it sort of seems to be coming from a different place in a way.
Yeah,
you know, it's like you're not consciously thinking of it, it just appears. And I think that happens even when you're conscious, right? If you're walking down the road and then you start, you know, singing something, or if I'm playing the harmonica and something comes, oh, I like that. Maybe I'll, make a piece of music. Maybe I'll write something down and, you know, start making a piece of music out of that. And it just sort of, I think when you've spent a lot of time playing and listening and playing with other people, It's very common for music to just sort of appear in your brain.
Yeah.
When I used to cycle a lot, I used to, you know, have music going through my head, and then now I walk, often get it walking, if I'm walking around, walking the dog or something. And
what if you're not feeling inspired, but you still have to write music and show up?
Oh, right. Good idea. I've been looking into different scales, and we talked about this. And I told you about this book I've got, and the scales of the world. I love that book. And I've gotten this harmonica company they'll retune the sidles. They'll retune the harmonicas. I told you about this, right? For a fee, they'll take one of their harmonicas and they'll retune it into a scale that they don't normally sell them in. And so I've been getting these different scales, and it's really fun. And I was just thinking recently, I guess I was listening to some tangos, you know, Astor Piazzolla, you know, him, Astor Piazzolla, wonderful Argentinian tango guy. And I was just thinking about tangos, and I was looking it up. And I was thinking that the distinctive quality of a tango is the rhythm, right? It's a dance. It's a dance form. And so the rhythm is ba-di-bum-bum or ba-da-di-bum-bum. And so I put them together and went ba-di-bum-bum, ba-ba-di-bum-bum, ba-di-bum-bum, ba-ba-di-bum-bum. And then I put them on this harmonica, which is attuned to Ahavo Rabo, which is a scale that is quite common in the Middle East, not really used in Western music, a little bit in Eastern European music. And it's a harmonic minor scale with a flat second.
Oh yeah.
So I took this harmonica.
Let's hear it.
The B flat harmonica that is retuned to Ahavo Rabo. So I just took that idea and said, I'm going to it seemed like a nice idea to put the tango rhythm onto this unusual scale. B flat, bravo, rabo.
Yeah.
So this is the most you asked about, you know, how do you, if you need to come up with a new piece. I just wrote this piece like a week ago. I'm still working on it, actually. But I started with those two ideas of the rhythm, so the distinctive rhythm and a distinctive scale and key, so that it just sort of automatically there was a piece of music that's really nice and quite original, you know, without even having to. Usually I come up, I think of a melody usually, and then I play it on the harmonica, and then I write it down and go from there, you know, come up with chords or whatever. Mm-hmm. And but if you're not feeling inspired, you could just do that.
Yeah.
Think of a scale, think of a key, and think of a rhythm that you would like to use, you know.
That's,
and you once you put those things together, like in this case, it starts by just going up the scale, you know, and you could just start like that, you know. If you've got musical knowledge, I think you can, if somebody comes up to you and says, oh, can you write a piece of music for me? I think once you've got some musical knowledge, it's not that difficult. You go, well, minor scale, major scale, different weird scale, you know, fast, slow, you know, rhythmic or more melodic or whatever. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So I want to summarize some of the things that you said, but also didn't say, but implied. See if you agree with this. So, you know, I've been teaching how to write fiddle tunes, and the thing that I know always works is by picking a rhythmic vibe and a tonal center.
Yeah.
You always can come up with something, whether or not. But the thing that you sort of implied but didn't say in addition to that is find the fun out of it, find the joy in it. I mean, that's good advice, I have to say.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, as I said, I thought, you know, I've been interested in tango, listening to some tangos, and then the idea of putting that with that unusual scale.
Right.
And you sort of automatically got something that was really fun and different, you know.
Yeah.
And so, and actually, that's why I said about that scale book is really useful like that, because it's got a, you know, if you're feeling like, oh, I don't want to write another piece in D minor or whatever, then you can sort of find a strange Greek scale or something and say, well, what happens if I do this? You know, for me, I always start by playing it on the instrument, you know.
Yeah.
Get some ideas maybe and then play it on the instrument, see what comes out. You know?
I like to
it
say
it comes out different. It comes out slightly different from what I'd originally thought usually.
Right. I like to say comfort zones are for wimps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's okay to be in comfort zones, but it's nice to sort of find different places to go with it, you know, because it's basically, it's infinite, isn't it? I mean, you know, you can play music, you can write music, and you can just keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. And I also find, as I said, we've been learning a lot of very old stuff, and that in itself, that there's this sort of sensibility that comes with some of those really old tunes that you can tune into that we don't necessarily, is not so common anymore, I guess is what I'm
right,
saying.
Right.
And you can go there just in terms of sentiment, you know.
Cool. Love that. You have a dog named Hector. You've had other dogs in the past, including Basher.
Yes.
And I just,
Georgia,
I just kind of, I know pets have been a big part of your lives. So I was wondering how you think having a pet changes your life.
Oh, well, I mean, for myself and also for Rachel, we both grew up with animals. My family always had animals. Her family always had animals. And I think that, you know, when you have a pet, when you like our little doggy here, it takes, the animals have a different sensibility. And so it takes you into a different place where you have to have a different sort of understanding. It's not so, I mean, people have been doing it for thousands of years, so it's not really that weird. But I think it, generally speaking, it makes you feel really happy. I mean, the classic thing of, you know, we'd come back from working at the theater all day and the doggy would be there and he'd be wagging his tail and we'd be like, hello. And even if we were feeling grumpy, he'd be, oh, there's our buddy and he's happy to see us. And that's so great. You know, it's a very simple relationship, basically, as long as you, you know, feed them and treat them well. Then, but they, dogs especially, I feel like they've changed their jobs to making you feel good. They used to have, like, he's a terrier. His terrier's jobs used to be catching rats and stuff, but now his job is to you know, make us feel happy and make us feel relaxed. And he wasn't that happy about the jam sessions this weekend because he wasn't the center of attention, you know. But he's sitting on my lap. He's so used to when we play. Because Rachel's playing the fiddle and she can't have him on her lap. But I play the harmonica, so he sits on my lap. So whenever we start playing, he comes and sits on my lap. And it's great. It's so sweet. It's such a nice thing. But yes, yeah. We talk about it a lot. It's like, how can people not have pets? It's such a joy. You know, I mean, I know it's a little bit of a trouble and, you know, some expense, but, you know, it's they give you so much joy. I mean, you know, you've got kitty cats, right?
That's right.
I love cats. Yeah, we both love cats. Unfortunately, Rachel found that she's allergic. I mean, we both love cats. We always had cats, but we can't have them anymore. But dogs are great, too. So they're all good. And, of course, a dog forces you to go for a walk, even if you don't feel like it.
That's right.
So it's sort of a good aspect.
But yeah,
I think that it's a very positive thing to have a pet. Even if it's just a goldfish, it's a good thing. Yeah.
Totally.
Anyway, how are your kitty cats? How are they doing?
Oh, our cats are good. They think that they're outdoor monsters of the food chain. And even Kiko has seen a bear, they've both seen moose, they're a little overconfident, so they want to get out.
Oh, dear.
And we take them out on leashes.
Oh, you do? Yeah. Well, that's where you live. That's probably a good idea.
How do people find your music? If they want to hear the music of Chris Turner, where can they go nowadays?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I and we and lots of bands we've been in and things, there are things up on the internet. So if you wanted to find something from me, for example, if you look up Chris Turner harmonica, there's a bunch of things. I mean, I'm not an internet person, as you know very well, but other people have, you know, videoed things and stuck things up and all that. So there's a lot of stuff, you know, scattered around. So if you look up Chris Turner harmonica, stuff will appear. And then, as you know, if you, you know, looking, Googling or YouTubing, you know, you check into that, and then it says, oh, and here's some other stuff, you know. So, yeah, you can check it out. Rachel has stuff. You look at the Nee Ningy Band, or...
And we're going to spell Nee Ningy for them. It's N-E-E, first word, second word, N-I-N-G-Y, the Nee Ningy Band.
Yeah, that's right. And we just got together with Ted, who's the mandolin player, singer, and revived a lot of our old repertoire this weekend. It was so much fun. It's like you can go for years, you know, with these things. And the same with my friends in England. You go for years without even seeing each other. Mm-hmm. And because we used to play together so much, you get together and all the stuff just reappears, you know, without any rehearsal. It's like, oh, there we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds great. Just and like it always did.
I just looked it up for those of you out there who have Spotify. The Nee Ningy Band is in Spotify. There's at least three albums in there. Look at that.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, more. Fantastic. There's a whole lot. We've got the Nee Ningy Band from 1979 with Gilgamesh, Stranger, Twilight Waltz. We got Swallowtail Jig EP,
great.
Get Nung, Just Wop It, and the Parlor Sessions. So.
Oh
yeah.
My God, that's great. The Parlor Sessions is fairly recent, just a few years ago. Yeah.
You're on the internet and it'll never go away. It'll be on the internet forever.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. As I said, we didn't do any of that, but someone did it. So, and that's all good as far as I'm concerned. You know, we always say, even if it's like music we wrote, even or stuff like that, if it's all for everybody. Music is for everyone. Music is for humans to share, you know. And so if people want to listen to it, listen to it, you know. And and hopefully we will do it with you before too long.
Chris Turner, what a pleasure. I love you, man.
Love you too, mate. And a great pleasure here. And let's do more before too long.
That's right.
Yeah.
No one ever said crossing the river of suck was easy. Or
it's
that
not.
You had to do it alone.
That's awesome. Right.
Thank you for giving it a chance and coming along for the ride. You can join the River of Suck swim team at riverofsuckswimteam.com. And you can join for just $1 a month and support this podcast. We've got more great episodes coming back. We've got interns from the Colorado University, CU Boulder here. And, a lot of good stuff coming your way, so keep on listening wherever podcasts are found. Thank you once more to Chris Turner for being an amazing guest, showing up for two interviews. So
great.
Till next time, keep swimming.
Swimming, keep swimming through the suck. Yay, yay, yay.
Yay.
Peace, brothers and sisters, peace. Yay.